We continue on today with Dr. McDaniel as he shares very holistic, very educated, and very necessary information regarding insulin, insulin resistance, and how to help assist our very capable bodies remain healthy or recover our health. Insulin, it's not just about diabetes anymore. I'm Robin Clare. Stay tuned for Tributaries. I'm wondering, is it a which came first, the chicken or the egg scenario regarding insulin resistance and stress? You just told us about how it does really affect our adrenals, but would stress kind of work backwards into the insulin, creating an insulin resistance or not?
Yeah, well, call it a vicious cycle because stress really worsens insulin resistance, yet high levels of insulin trigger the stress response. So there are lots of ways with the insulin resistance in which this whole thing feeds forward, and that's why it's so important for our patients to break the cycle, to start, you know, doing the three or four major things that are required to turn insulin resistance back into something that could be helpful. If somebody brings down the power grid, you know, we're going to be hungry and we're going to be stressed, and all of a sudden it may be really cool to be have a body mass index of 32. At least until they get the grid back up.
Right, right. Well, I definitely want to cover that piece with you, but I just wanted to talk to you a little bit more about how one of the other things that happens with excess insulin is how it mimics other hormones. And I've been working for a long time with, for instance, with people, this is totally aside, but similar in that, you know, people often with reflux, you know, Western medicine will hold firm that, oh, you've got too much acid. And we hold you don't have enough of the hydrochloric acid, so your body's pulling other acids into the system. So when I'm sure this insulin is mimicking other hormones, it's just, you know, you mentioned tumors and cancers grow more rapidly. I mean, what does that look like? And then we'll move into, folks, we're going to move into pretty common sense and good ways to prevent any of this from going on, and if it already is, ways to help turn it around.
Fantastic. All right. You know, you asked me about high blood pressure, and I completely forgot to mention one of the hormones that insulin mimics. Insulin seems to mimic the effect of the hormone aldosterone. And aldosterone tells our kidney to, hey, pull salt back out of the urine and save salt. You know, people with high blood pressure are always told, don't eat salt. And one of the drug companies has in line a non-steroidal aldosterone blocker, so people will pee out their salt. So insulin, in mimicking aldosterone, raises our body volume, raises our salt, and, of course, raises our blood pressure. Insulin mimics growth hormone. You mentioned the cancers. And this is not actually, everybody knows it, but nobody's thought about it. Because the first chapter of Williams Endocrinology, they talk about cross-reactivity at receptors. And the example they give is insulin and growth hormone. Growth hormone is secreted by the pituitary gland, and it promptly goes to the liver where it is activated into, get this, insulin-like growth factor, 1 and 2. They've even got the same first name. And so insulin and growth hormone cross-react on each other's receptors, and they insulin acts like growth hormone. So it's no wonder that obese people have more cancer. And when obese people get cancer, they're more likely to die of it because insulin causes obesity, and insulin causes cancers to grow. It doesn't cause cancer to start, maybe. Maybe it does. There are some papers that think maybe high insulin affects the way we read our DNA, or maybe it damages DNA. But it pretty darn surely makes cancers grow faster, so fast that the cancer escapes the control of the immune system. You know, they think we make cancer cells every day. It's just our immune system recognizes, hey, this doesn't belong here, and gets rid of it. But if the cancer is growing too fast for the immune system to get it all, well, then it looks like the dust around the house. It's just piling up, okay? The stomach acid piece is intriguing. Insulin has a direct effect on the hypothalamus, on the hypothalamus and vagus. It would seem to increase gastric production of acid. So I think in a nation where 40% of us are insulin resistant and 35% of us are obese, and we tend to eat lots and lots of food that stimulates insulin release, it's no wonder that doctors think a lot of us have too much acid. Now, your comment about too little acid is very smart, and it's true. The stimulus to close off the top of the stomach so stomach contents don't wash up into our very sensitive esophagus is stomach acid. And oddly enough, when people take the drug metformin to treat insulin resistance, then they make more stomach acid. So this business gets a little complicated, but it's undoubtedly related.
Yes.
You know, when I was an intern, we used to actually operate on people for ulcers, if you can believe that. And back in the 30s and 40s and 50s, they used to whack up pieces of the stomach. But in the 70s, they developed an operation called a highly selective vagotomy with pyloroplasty. So they would cut open the patient. They'd follow the vagus nerve that carries the message from the brain to the stomach to make acid, and they'd cut all the branches to the stomach so it wouldn't get the message to make acid. Of course, then they had to open the pylorus to drain it. And we used to do a test about 2 weeks later to see how well we had done. We would put an NG tube down, we measured the acidity of the stomach, and then we give them an injection of insulin. And the insulin was a big stimulus to stomach acid. That was the proof test. So there's no doubt that high insulin affects stomach acid, and probably both ways.
Yes. I'm wondering, because of what you're saying and the insulin, the way that it makes cancers and tumors grow, I'm wondering, is this addressed very much by the oncological community of doctors?
No. Oh. No, it's not. I go to grand rounds at the university as often as I can because it's great. But I have twice now, once in medicine grand rounds and once in surgery, heard the speaker question, why do obese people have more cancers? And they couldn't answer it. These are the visiting firemen who are the big experts, oncologists. So, no, it's not well recognized. And there's confusion, too. There's a chap on the West Coast who does injections of insulin into the tumors, and that messes them up, too. So, you know, it's a field that confuses a lot of docs, and most all docs just have the idea that high insulin is, so what, ho-hum, it just is a poor hormone that can't work. But no, it's a bad player.
Yeah. I remember years ago there was a doctor in the Chicago area, I believe, who was putting people into a diabetic coma to cure their cancers.
I don't know anything about that, really. But yes, whether it's a diabetic coma or an insulin-induced coma, you know, sometimes you can make people's blood sugar get so daggone low by giving them insulin, they'll keel over. I'm thinking Steel Magnolias in that famous Julia Roberts scene in The Beauty Shop where she has an insulin reaction. I would suspect maybe he was putting them into an insulin reaction with low blood sugar rather than, you know, when you say diabetic coma, we usually think somebody whose blood sugar is so high it sucked all the juice out of his brain and he keels over. Boy, that's ugly.
Right. Yeah.
So I'm not sure exactly what the guy was doing. But, you know, it may be based on the fact that cancer cells are very primitive. They have to eat like every other cell, but they don't have the backup food supply that healthy cells do.
Yes.
So
yes.
Maybe that was where he was going with it. Hard to know.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a cure for cancer, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, I mean, even if there was one, it would take another how many years to for everyone to hear about it. You know, there are lots of various ones, and it just goes to show there's no one cure for everything.
Depends on who's paying for it, probably.
Right.
If Big Pharma came out with it,
he says, laughing like it's a joke, right? Well, let's dive in a bit into insulin's diet, lifestyle, supplements, and drugs and herbs. And I think the interesting fact, first off, is that many, if not most, mainstream diet plans were really concocted and devised or thought about before all of this insulin resistance information was understood.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, that's how Dr. Atkins up in New York City became so incredibly successful, but at the same time so catastrophically ostracized by his colleagues in the medical community. Because up until the late 60s, everybody thought that obesity and overweight was simply a matter of eating too many calories.
I know, these
and
poor
anybody
people.
Who's done basic accounting would understand that. You put a lot of energy in, you don't take it out, you get a bigger account, you know? But Atkins' patients came to him, and some of mine have too, and they will cry, and they say, I only eat 800 calories a day, and I still can't lose weight. What's wrong? And Atkins got the idea of looking at what they're eating, and they were eating 800 calories of starch every day. And so now that we understand what Atkins did, we realize that in order to get people healthy again, we got only two simple goals. Number one is improve their insulin sensitivity, and number two, reduce their need to make insulin. Mm-hmm. And that's all it takes. Just give them a diet that doesn't require that much insulin, and then you work on their lifestyle so that they improve their insulin sensitivity. So shall I talk about the diet?
Yes. But first, cool. one more question, because you do, I'm sure you'll be talking about the low glycemic index and slowly accessible glucose, and then the low insulinemic index. Mm-hmm. But you mentioned carbs already. And not fats. Mm-hmm. And it's my understanding that in earlier times, people knew it was fat that gave them energy, not carbs. So can you talk a little bit about that difference first?
Well, fat is great stuff. You know, plants can't really make much in the way of fat. They store their energy as starch. And we store our energy mostly as fat, which is really efficient. You can store more than twice as much energy per gram in fat. So we get to walk around where potatoes just lay underground. Fat is concentrated energy, and it does not raise our insulin. We don't have to use insulin in order to metabolize and deal with our energy from fat. Fat got a really bad reputation back in the 60s because it is so calorie rich. Remember the picture of the baked potato and the pot of butter? They said there are more calories in the pot of butter than in the baked potato. And so people who are, they fix on calories, say eat the potato, shun the fat. And people who understand insulin resistance, so you eat the fat, shun the potato, or scrape out the white stuff and eat the potato skin with butter and sour cream on it. Put some bacon on there, too. It'd be delicious. So, you know, I think a healthy diet, if you look at the macronutrients, I agree with Campbell, who wrote the China study. I think probably you should have 40, maybe 50% of your total calories come from carbohydrates. But the key is it's got to be the right kind of carbs. And then you divide the other 50 or 60% evenly between protein and fat, and you have basically a really healthy diet. But the key to understanding insulin resistance is understanding how the carbohydrates we eat affect our body. Shall we get into that? Or
please
did
do,
I
yes.
do an okay job?
No, you're doing great. You're doing very great.
We get by. So when you look at the carbs in the diet, that is really the key to insulin resistance. We need carbs. We got to have carbs. We have to have them to process. And we want to have the type of carbohydrates that can be described in three ways. Way back in 1981, Jenkins produced the first paper written for diabetics with an eye of controlling their blood sugar. And he looked at the different kinds of foods in the American diet and asked, how does this carbohydrate affect my patient's blood sugar? How does this food affect the sugar? So what Jenkins did was he got a whole bunch of volunteers, who I assume were graduate students and undergrads, and paid them to drink 100 grams of glucose. And then he drew blood every 15 minutes for 2 hours. And he measured how does their blood sugar change after taking 100 grams of just glucose. And then he gave them all different kinds of food, white potatoes, bread, carrots, ice cream, fructose, you name it, all sorts of food. And he did exactly the same thing. He checked their blood sugar for the next 2 hours, and he compared the raise in blood sugar against glucose. So the glycemic index, when you say carrots have a glycemic index of 70, it means if you eat 100 grams of carrots, it will raise your blood sugar 70% as high as if you had 100 grams of pure glucose. And he applied that to things like cauliflower and broccoli that have a really low glycemic index. And he came up with a good diet, a great diet for type 1 diabetics particularly. And it's been shown to help type 2 diabetics and people with insulin resistance and metabolic syndrome. It is one of the pieces of the puzzle, but it's not the only piece by any means. A number of people, interestingly, some of the Francophones, the French-speaking researchers, have looked at what affects the glycemic index. And they realize when you eat a carbohydrate, your digestive enzymes, starting with amylase in your mouth, start breaking apart the sugars that make up the carbohydrate. And the question is, how fast are those sugars released into your bloodstream? When you have white bread, it is exactly the same as drinking glucose. You might as well have a slice of sugar as a slice of white bread. The blood sugar and the insulin are the same effect. And if you have broccoli, you have very slow rise of blood sugar and minimum, you know, effects. And so the slowly accessible glucose or slow carbs is the second thing to consider when you eat a carbohydrate. The bad kinds are the white ones or the golden brown fluffy ones, you know, like white bread and white potatoes and white rice and the pastas. And the good ones are the carbs that are green, orange, yellow, red, and purple, you know, eggplants and broccoli. And cauliflower is a brother, you know, it's an albino. It's okay, even though it's white. And then the third thing was, how much does a food crank up our insulin? And this is something that was only conceived of in 1994 when a group from Australia thought they would take a look at Jenkins' glycemic index and see how did it apply to insulin. So they gave a bunch of volunteers a certain amount of food, and they measured insulin after the food. And they developed what is now called the insulinemic index. And this is hugely important for people trying to lose weight. And the reason I say that is that sweeteners, non-nutritive sweeteners, including not just Splenda and NutraSweet and aspartame and saccharin and stuff that nobody's trusted, really. You know, we all kind of don't think, that doesn't sound right. But stevia and agave and natural sweeteners, they have a zero glycemic index. They have zero slowly accessible glucose, but their insulinemic index is through the roof.
That's something I definitely wanted you to say, because the diet soda thing makes people gain weight, and they don't understand it, but yeah. Now they can. Just that sweet flavor on the lips starts the process, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And they've actually, the nation of Australia showed that. They caught the Australian paradox. They've replaced their nutritive sweeteners, you know, glucose, beet sugar, corn sugar, high fructose sugar. They replaced it with non-nutritive sweeteners, and their obesity went up. And the reason for this is that insulin is released by two signals. The first signal is a sweet taste on your tongue. There's a reflex to the hypothalamus that tells your body, here comes the sugar, release the insulin, and we do. And once we swallow that bolus of sweet-tasting food, the same exact type of taste buds, literally taste buds, in our upper small bowel, release incretins, they call them, that travel in the blood to the pancreas and say, yeah, it's coming, release the insulin. And in fact, Trulicity and Januvia, there are a number of drugs now that simply stimulate those gastrointestinal taste buds to release incretins. And they're giving that as treatment for diabetics. And stevia, they've been trying to develop some of the stevia proteins called steviosides to do the same thing. So this stuff is potent. And when we eat food or drink drinks with non-nutritive sweeteners, we are stimulating insulin release. So what happens when we stimulate a bunch of insulin release, but we haven't had any sugar? Well, your blood sugar bottoms out. So, of course, that's why you see these poor old souls waddling around with a can of Diet Pop in one hand and a bag of chips in the other. They got to have the chips because they're making themselves hypoglycemic if they don't eat the chips. And all that does is increase the insulin, which is a fat storage hormone. Insulin is an energy storage hormone. It's anabolic. And so the sweeteners are doing that to us.
Yes.
Wow.
And, yes, and this has gone on too long, I say.
Alan, yes.
Yes, Alan.
Hit the barricades.
Right. Let's give the police something worthwhile to do here. Anyway, we're winding down time-wise, and what do you recommend? I mean, I want to ask you what you recommend for the diabetic. What supplements do you recommend for people to help keep these things in check, maybe even though they don't necessarily have this going on? You just covered diet a little bit. And then when is it time for an actual pharmaceutical drug, and can you take people off of them?
Well, you can. And the key thing is, can a diabetic comes to me. I measure their fasting blood sugar, and I measure their fasting insulin. And sometimes I'll measure their two-hour postprandial glucose, but I always measure the insulin. So when a person is a diabetic with no insulin, they need insulin, and they probably need drugs. When a person is a diabetic with a bunch of insulin, we may be able to get them off of all of the drugs. You asked about supplements. Chromium is a nutritive trace metal, and for some reason, people with insulin resistance lose chromium. And chromium is so important because it's one of the trace metals that make those dysfunctioning translocation proteins work better. So people with insulin resistance have a double whammy regarding chromium. They need the chromium for their somewhat lame translocation proteins to work, but they lose the chromium they need the most. So chromium picolinate, or even better, chromium trichloride, is excellent. It can hurt you if you take so much you drown in it. And theoretically, if you took a huge amount, it could block your uptake of iron and make you a little anemic, but it's pretty doggone safe stuff if you take it sensibly. Vanadium has been touted as a nutraceutical, and there's a surprising amount of research in that in the National Library of Medicine. They say maybe it's good. I haven't had my hair blown back by vanadium, but wow, chromium helps people. But the lifestyle is another huge piece. An editor in JAMA wrote sarcastically, he was put out, why do we get excited by a new drug when diet and exercise, diet and lifestyle, are 10 times more potent? So I know we're running low on time. All I got to say is get between 8 and 9 hours of sleep and that de-stresses you and improves your insulin resistance enormously. Professor Moss from Cornell said, if you get 8 hours of sleep a night, you're going to lose a pound a week. You can hardly help yourself. And I bet he's right. And physical activity is huge. If we can do something 30 minutes every day, it is fantastic, because our muscles are the key target of insulin resistance, and our muscles take up 70% of the sugar we get in a meal. And when we exercise our muscles, they become greatly more insulin sensitive, and the whole system works phenomenally better. So the reason Americans are struggling so much, we don't get enough sleep, we don't get enough exercise, and we're eating sweet, starchy foods. We're like fat kids in a candy store. You know, nobody's telling us no. So we didn't know. Now we're learning.
Yes, and with the physical... Great. And with the physical exercise, maybe you can only walk a block at this time. Tomorrow, walk your block and take 10 more steps.
Well, the intriguing alternative is on a BBC production by a Dr. Mosley, and it's called The Truth About Exercise. And it is an amazing show. Some people are genetically disposed not to do well going to the gym and pumping weights for an hour. Mosley was one of them. He did that, and he got nowhere. And he ran into a guy named Timmons at the University of Edinburgh and showed him that you get on a little exercise bike and you just pump the treadles as fast as you can for 30 seconds. And then you wait till you get your heart rate back down to about 100, and you do it again for 30 seconds. And you do that 3 times a week. In 4 weeks, which was 12 minutes of exercise, Mosley controlled his blood sugar with half as much insulin following a challenge test. And there's other medical research that shows the same thing. Some of our patients, you know, Robin, are so puny. They're so beat down. They really cannot do more than that one block.
Right.
And so you need to build them up, not only with their endurance, but, you know, give them adrenal nutrition. Look at their thyroid. Look at all the different hormonal adaptations their body has made to the stress of chronic illness and chronic pain. And, you know, insulin causes chronic pain. Fibromyalgia comes from insulin resistance, too. So this has deep, deep implications in the chronic health problems that Americans suffer from and have not gotten good results from Western medicine.
Well, this has been incredible, and I so look forward to our next chat, which we'll cover maybe in about 3 months, and we'll do something again.
Well, I can't wait.
Dr. Alan McDaniel. Look for him on Tributaries in the coming months, as we will be discussing some more very cutting edge and important healthcare information. If you missed part one, or like me, if you want to give it another listen, for all guest information, all archives, to share resources and sign up for weekly notices, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. And for podcasting on iTunes, Tributaries Radio. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.